This is Rabbi G, and welcome to Harvard God and Gen Z. The goal of this podcast is to discuss life's big questions with some of America's brightest young minds. We will discuss Harvard's continued sway on the imagination as the peak of success. We will discuss how to get there and what it is like when you do. We will then shift to discuss if and in what ways meaning and God are relevant features of Gen Z. What better place than Harvard for discussing these issues with the thought leaders of tomorrow? Okay, welcome back. We are super excited here today because we have finally our first undergraduate current Harvard student here with us today, a true blue Gen Zer, someone who hails from what I would term the second holiest city in the world. Obviously, number one in my mind is Jerusalem, but following maybe relatively close behind this, definitely Chicago. Okay, I grew up there, I'll be honest, but it's still a great city. So I would like to introduce Matthew Miller, a senior majoring in applied mathematics. Welcome, Matt. How are you?
Thanks. Yeah, I'm good. Thanks for having me on the podcast. Excited to get into it.
All right, let's get into it a little bit. So you grew up in, as I mentioned, right outside of Chicago. Was Harvard on the map your whole life? When did it get on the map? What was it like to get there?
Definitely to an extent on the map growing up. I did the summer school program in high school, was there for like 7 weeks taking a couple classes, and that there I got to see the campus and meet a lot of people. So I think that's really
when you say when you were at the campus.
Maybe not exactly. I mean, I had been once before with my family just on vacation when we went to Boston, but that was, you know, obviously more superficial. But I think over time I grew to really like the area, the people there, the buildings. Yeah. I mean, it was first sight in terms of colleges because I hadn't really visited any others, but I don't know if love came immediately.
Okay, fair enough. We went straight for the top. Was there a lot of pressure to get to the top, or was, you know, if it worked out, great. If not, you know, all good too. What was the vibe growing up?
I think I definitely put a lot of pressure on myself. I don't think I felt it really from my parents or peers. I don't think anyone was externally making me feel like I had to do this or that, which was pretty nice. I think my parents and my family always celebrated when I could achieve something, but I never felt like they were expecting or pushing me to do anything. So
I'm so curious. This is something I'm probably most curious about when I meet Harvard students. There is something unique in terms of this inner drive, this really intrinsic motivation to get to, you know, to just be excellent at what they do. Can you tell me more about that? Can you explain that? Is that cultural? Is it just you were born that way? Where does that come from? What's the motivation?
That's interesting. I think it comes from doing things that people are passionate about. Like, I, at least for me in high school, I always got involved in activities that I enjoyed, like debate and student council. And I saw role models in those activities that were kind of excelling and going to schools, you know, on the caliber of Harvard or Yale or et cetera. And I think that kind of helped foster my drive. But I think much of this drive is often like a byproduct of people following their passions and doing things they enjoy.
So what do you think, what most people you would claim just don't have passions or are distracted, so they're not in touch with their passions. So what does it mean to have passions? What does that entail? And why not really have those passions? They just kind of go through high school, look for a nice easy party, and then just not interested. They check out.
I would argue that passion like comes from action, and you have to actually get involved in something and then you can claim you're passionate about it. Like, you know, you're not passionate about debate and therefore you get involved in the club. You get involved in the club, you know, really put a lot of effort and time into it, and then you're passionate. So I think passion, at least the way I see it, often comes as a result of what you involve yourself in, and same with the drive. Like, you have to start somewhere, and maybe for these kids you're mentioning that never really get into it or are super driven, it's because they never joined a community that they thought was worth the time.
You're saying it's actually a very big Jewish concept, this idea of action first will actually stimulate internal drive. So right. That's something you kind of discovered on your own, that I should just try things. And sure enough, when you put yourself out there, life kind of speaks to you and you start waking up.
Sure.
Pretty amazing. And the day you got in was a special day for you?
Yeah, it was definitely an emotional one. I drove home from Model UN practice with my sister, tried opening my laptop to check it, but it was dead. So I had to plug it in while my family was just kind of waiting awkwardly. And yeah, definitely really exciting. One of my friends from school kind of broke the news without me realizing it by posting something on Facebook. And so all of a sudden I was just getting all these calls and texts. And
were you the only one in your class to go there from Deerfield?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. And, all right. So you get to Harvard, and does it live up to its expectations? Was it a positive experience? You're a senior now, obviously, not having a classic senior year quite yet, but at least the first 3 years, did Harvard stimulate you? Was it the place you felt that it would be?
I think so, yeah. In many ways, for sure. I mean, just looking back, I feel like I got involved in a lot of different activities that I enjoyed, and that gave me cool opportunities, met so many fascinating people, was able to learn a lot in classes. I think some of the novelty was gone of the university experience because I had done that summer school program I mentioned earlier. So it wasn't, you know, like,
that's it. All it took is one summer school program and that's it. It's already.
Yeah. Well, 7 weeks. I mean, you know, it's like you know where everything is. You've kind of gone around the Boston area. So it's less like this magical kind of distant Camelot when you get there.
Right.
Having already lived there and taken classes, but I think so. Yeah. I think if I could go back and do one thing differently, I would have maybe invested more in academics. I definitely feel like I got a lot of my classes, but sometimes I felt like I didn't do as much as I did in high school to kind of learn the material, really study it, reach out to the professors. I think getting there almost sometimes makes you complacent or feel like you reach the end of the road and you don't know what's next. So you don't. Yeah.
What was the greatest lesson you think you learned at Harvard from a class or a professor or anything that sticks out, a life lesson, piece of wisdom?
That's interesting. That's a tough question. I would say that it's really the people that get you through things, and that you can glorify academics and extracurricular activities as much as you want, but really the most valuable part of any experience, at least in my opinion, was the relationships. And in high school, I don't think I really realized that because everything felt like just like about myself and improving in debate or getting an A in the class or et cetera. And in college, I think I stopped and smelled the roses a little bit and said, oh, there are like a lot of really cool people around here. And maybe this is because in high school, I wasn't surrounded by as many wonderful, experienced, you know, mature, thoughtful individuals. But I think getting to college, you realize how much there is to learn from other people, and you start trying to like reach out to more people and have more meaningful relationships. So I think that's something that I learned about, admire it. So
would you describe your Harvard experience as fulfilling or stimulating or just a nice vehicle for opportunities the rest of your life?
I think it was very fulfilling, but not in perhaps the ways that I expected. I think I expected it to be academically, you know, what made me whole and, you know, this big advancement in my studies, or like, you know, I would get super into, I don't know, economics or government and become like the foremost student on, on that topic. And I think conversely, basically what happened was that I ended up getting really into extracurricular activities like debate and Model UN, and even giving tours, for example, getting really into like intramural sports, my residential house life, et cetera. And I think those were bigger sources of fulfillment for me than this big academic kind of impression that I had of it going in.
What's your definition of fulfillment, if I were to ask you? You know, what makes something fulfilling as opposed to something you enjoy? Something
unsatisfactory.
More? Right. What defines fulfillment?
I'm no expert, but I would argue that fulfillment is doing something for its own sake without any sort of external moment or external like motivations or concerns. I think something that you can do and be fully present in, and then look back at it and find meaning. And I mean, if you I know we talked about The Last Dance, the Chicago Bulls kind of documentary, and in the last episode, I forgot who had the quote, but someone was saying how Michael Jordan was always present, like his
Yes,
mind
that's
was
right. He was
never.
always zoned in. He was always zoned in for years at a time and just always there.
Right. And never in the
I remember that.
past, never, worried about the future. And I feel like that's maybe, at least maybe not for everyone, but for him, that, that seems like a fulfilling experience. Like having that,
Sure.
you always talk about DOS, like having that, that presence and that gratitude for the moment. I don't know. I think that activities that
So
are
doing that, so
conducive
you're
to
saying for
that.
you, fulfilling activities means doing something in the moment that's intrinsically valuable to you, allows you to be present. You're not doing it for any other reason, and in that moment, you feel. You mentioned the word gratitude. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, one perspective that I've started to come to is that presence and gratitude kind of go hand in hand. And when you're, I don't know, taking a walk, like you can do it so absentmindedly and just like your mind is somewhere else, like on the next assignment you have or, some email you have to send, and you don't even stop and smell the roses. You don't really see the foliage around you, and so you're not present. But I think a step to getting presence is saying, oh wow, like the tree line today looks beautiful. Being grateful for like the nice weather while you have it, or being grateful for being able to walk in good health. And then I think like those statements of gratitude, at least when I have those kinds of inner monologues, I'm much more present and, observant of what's around me and just feel more fulfilled, frankly. But it's a habit I'm trying to get more into.
That's beautiful. Now, two questions on the gratitude. I had this long debate many years ago with a student. Does the gratitude need to have an object? In other words, you have to be grateful to something, like thank you, and there's a you at the end of that, or just thank X. At the end of the day, is it not true that when you say thank you, you're either thanking the universe, like thank you, universe, for being you, or you're thanking, I guess, the person who or the being that created that universe? Does it have to have a, you believe that gratitude should have an object, or does it have an object in your when you say you're grateful to what?
Yeah, I would say I'm feel gratitude towards some sort of higher being. Like I don't, when I am grateful for my good health and being able to take a walk unimpeded without, like the other day I walked past a kid around my age who I don't know exactly which disorder he has, but he's, his parents kind of take him around in a wheelchair on a walk, and I think he has, just a few things going on. And I was like, and I hate to do it by comparison, but I was like, I'm so grateful just that I'm able to take a walk without having any of these like logistical impediments.
Sure.
And that felt to me like I didn't really attribute it to nature. I kind of attributed it to some higher being that, luckily put that opportunity in my hands. I think when I walk around looking at like foliage, or when I, when I'm admiring nature, I don't know if I'm necessarily, and maybe my mindset should shift, but I don't know if I'm necessarily thanking anyone or any, construct. I'm just kind of thankful for it in and of itself. Just like,
The beauty.
wow. Yeah, right. And not, and maybe like I could attribute it to, to God or to, the creation of the universe, but in my head, I don't know if that's where I'm at. Maybe it's something that I'll get to soon, but I think when it's more related to myself and my health or the opportunities I've had, that's where I feel like I
More
am more
personal.
grateful. Yeah, it's more personal, and I feel more grateful to like to God.
Interesting. It's actually funny. There's a great story that this one rabbi used to tell his students that every time you go to the bathroom, you should really call your parents and tell them that everything's okay. Not just because Jewish parents tend to worry a lot, but the reality is, if you study biology, you study the nephron unit of the kidney, it's incredible how much is going right in our lives every single day. And we tend to focus on the one or two things that aren't going right, but thousands of things are going well. As you mentioned beautifully, that even if it does take a certain comparison to get there, but I agree with you. I think gratitude is a very powerful thing. So you mentioned that for you, it is intuitive to thank a higher being. Was the concept of a higher being something you always believed in, something your family spoke about growing up, a new concept for you? What's been your attitude towards that idea of a higher being?
Yeah, I think it's definitely something my family spoke about, or that I learned in Hebrew school, et cetera. Now I feel like it's more of my own belief system. Like I feel like I before it always felt like I was kind of being fed stuff to think.
Sure.
And I'm not, you know, criticizing the Hebrew school system at all. I think in many ways it's great, but it never really felt like my own.
I've never heard the word great used attributed to it, but that's
yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll take it.
Like I think it, you know, I don't know. I feel like it definitely instilled in me, you know, some appreciation for Judaism. I'm sure there are, you know, it's flaws and
sure.
As there are in everything, but
sure.
You know, I feel like I'm grateful to have been able to do it.
So you think that exposed you enough, but when did you start owning it yourself and on what basis do you feel you owned the idea?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think after your bar mitzvah, there's this weird, at least in Deerfield that I've observed, there's this like kind of weird break in religiosity where you're like, okay, I'm done. You know, I've graduated from.
It's the retirement party in many circles.
Right, right. And there are other opportunities to be involved, but they're kind of less attended, et cetera. So I feel like I took maybe a break, maybe even through high school, because I just felt like, I don't know, in high school, it always felt, we talked about this as well, but it felt like my own work and my own successes were my own and, you know, virtue of my own studiousness and time investment. And then I think in college, when I was independent and on my own and just like exposed to a whole new world where I had to like kind of rethink just the schema that I like view life through, I think that's where maybe it started to, you know, reappear. And then also speaking with you and going to some things with Hillel, I feel like I had more independent and individual kind of religious exposure. And that's where I feel like it started to come back.
So Harvard is known to some extent as not the place you find God per se, maybe more on the atheist side of things. Would you say there is one sway over the other? Would you say most of your peers also found that there is a possibility of a higher power, or is there one direction or another atmosphere at Harvard, or felt, no, you can find anything. It just depends where you look and there's not really one direction or another.
I think it's hard to tell because it's pretty absent from the dialogue. And I don't know. I think there's like this idea of at school that because it's very diverse, everyone kind of has their own faiths and is kind of like, it's more of an individual thing and an independent thing than necessarily like a collective point of discussion or activity. I know there's like the interfaith group and I've never been to any of their programming, but just generally observing kind of like the, you know, what gets talked about among students, it's hard to tell because it's kind of more relegated to the private individual sphere.
So it's never a conversation that comes up with among friends. Hey, what do you?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, usually I think it's conversations are more oriented toward either classes or activities or more just like interpersonal things. But I don't know. I mean, I've definitely had conversations where it got kind of philosophical and then, you know, religion was kind of brought in and discussed and people would say, you know, talk about kind of their belief system, but I wouldn't say it's like a focal point of discussion.
So you said you got involved, you had a few experiences. Was there a conclusive moment where you're like, okay, now I see why I would believe in this, or just kind of gradual through many experiences, you said you would say to yourself philosophically, this makes sense?
I think more gradual, just through a bunch of different experiences. I think, you know, the steak breaks were always kind of gave me little nuggets to think about after. And like walking back from the Mayor apartment with like, you know, the kind of the crew, often we would just like ruminate on things that were said. And then I would kind of take it back to my dorm room and like replay kind of things in my head. But I don't think there was one definitive, you know, quote or moment or interaction that necessarily got me back into it. I do think you were at this event, but the Pizza and Politics that we hosted with the Political Union and Sarah Hurwitz, where she talked about her book about kind of refinding Judaism and things like that, I think that was definitely something that I thought about. And I have a copy of her book, which I started reading, but I
Great
confess
book, yeah.
I haven't finished. Yeah. So those kind of little moments, I feel like kind of add up, you know?
So someone asked you though, point blank, like why philosophically do you feel it's, you know, again, logical, non-regressive thinking to say, yeah, it makes sense that there's something else out there. How would you answer that question?
Kind of like what you said before with the nephrons and the kidney. I mean, there's just so many things that have to go right. And often I think it comes from gratitude for us to be living the way we are. And also there's so much that's unexplained. And even the explained, I feel like, you know, it just kind of logically makes sense. I don't know. Yeah, I think it's hard to really explain that to somebody without them, kind of like how I mentioned action turns into, you know, beliefs and drive and motivation, without, you know, doing these kind of things, like going
just
to
exposing yourself to these ideas in
right.
some way. And that just gets you thinking. And then you start to see the world in different ways. And you start, you know, a lot of things you just mentioned now are really powerful. The theological argument of design and mm-hmm. complexity of everything and how mathematically right. it's hard to understand how all this all fits together. Mm-hmm. You know, that unexplainable consciousness where everything comes together.
Yeah.
And yeah, those are all there. And I always love to share my first discussion with people is always that mm-hmm. the name Jew comes from the word gratitude. Mm-hmm. The essence of the word Yehudi, which means Jew, is the word Hoda'ah, which means gratitude. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. I think gratitude is a huge component of everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you find that it's in people when they are not exposed or are missing this, are living more nihilistic life per se? Or do you feel that, okay, I'm glad I found it, but it's not necessary for everybody. What is your thought on that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, for me, like I said, it was kind of like I had to expose myself to things and then get this belief system. Like if you were to present someone with a belief system and then just tell them to believe it, it's much harder to take that approach. I think in terms of, you know, individuals who don't necessarily find, you know, who are more nihilist or agnostic per se, I don't know. I feel like everyone kind of approximates some belief system or another mm-hmm. and is yearning for something to an extent religious, whether or not they really know it.
Can you elaborate on that? What would an example of a yearning that...
Well, even just like, I'm trying to think, like fervent allegiance to a sports team, for example, mm-hmm. like, you know, you believe that, and maybe this is, I don't know if you would call it paganism, but you believe that like, if you're a Heat fan, like Jimmy Butler and Goran Dragic and their stars are like, you know, this powerful force for good that is, you know, and maybe I'm not explaining myself super well, but
it's good. No, like, what do we call sports here? We call them sport idols.
Right. Yeah. You know, and
it's not too far off.
Sure. And I don't know. I think the sense of wanting to belong to a sports team fan base or, you know, to this thing greater than yourself, which, you know, in more modern times is maybe a country or, you know, even just like being proud of being from your city. Like you want to be part of something bigger than yourself. And you think that when you're like a proud Chicago and you're like, there's something godly or there's something, you know, inexplicable about the city of Chicago that I'm so grateful for and that I'm so, you know, like almost obsessed with. And I feel like those kinds of mental like approximations or like things we do for affiliation and like belief systems are often, you know, already kind of embedded in or correlated with religion. And then, yeah, I guess I would leave it at that.
Okay. So you find there's things that are stand-ins or
right
bigger than, and people treat them almost as if, or almost in a religious way. And in some ways, sure. almost a stand-in for the fact that nowadays we are kind of bereft of a classic notion of a divine concept.
Sure. Yeah. And even, I feel like if you spent, you know, 15 minutes with the nihilist, eventually they would say something that has, you know, like some sense of an religious basis, you know, like, oh, I really hope that, you know, I really hope that my daughter is in good health and that like she's taken care of, you know, or like mm-hmm, mm-hmm. there's
it's
always
a,
this
it's
appeal
a plea to the universe or to the
right
to the stars in a way that right. things should work out. I hear that. So you mentioned that the key for you was just getting involved. So mm-hmm. let's say you wanted to, you think it's a good, you know, maybe provided certain benefit or meaning in your life. Mm-hmm. How would you tell someone in your generation that's skeptical? Mm-hmm. You know what? Listen, just I'm telling you, it's not regressive. It's mm-hmm. not unintellectual to believe. How would you articulate it? What would you tell someone? Hey, just expose yourself. There's actually a lot mm-hmm. here. How would you say it?
Well, I guess I would just say I can see where you're coming from because, you know, today with technology and like the maxim of human excellence, it's easy to, you know, believe that humans are just kind of responsible for their own course and everything is scientific, etc. But maybe just go to one or two talks that, you know, you might not agree with from the outset, but go with an open mind, ask your own questions from your own point of view when they come up and just see what the explanation is and consider it. You know, like you don't have to overhaul your belief system overnight. You don't, I'm not asking you to abandon every single tenet that you adhere to within the minute, but just check it out. Like, there's a reason that, you know, there's a reason that Judaism or whatever religion you're talking about has pervaded and persisted for so long. And it's because it's powerful and it gives people something to believe in. And, you know, you might not be there right now, but at least give it a chance, you know? And also you can meet it in the middle. Like, you don't have to become, you know, some sort of saint immediately, right?
Sure.
But just, you know, kind of check it out.
Great. So just get that exposure and you realize that it's more intellectual probably than you thought, and at least it'll be food for thought at the very least.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the hardest step is always that first exposure. I think once people have some exposure, they realize, oh, this is actually quite relevant and interesting. And I think at the end of the day, we're all finite beings who realize our mortality, and can't ignore these things. And these things will eventually, I think obviously this year with the pandemic, we've all been on some level more in touch with our fragility and with the fact that life is unpredictable. And as much as we want to control everything and figure everything out, human beings we're being outsmarted by an animate microscopic molecule. And I think this year especially has been one where people are more open in some way to what you describe.
Sure. Yeah, and you mentioned earlier, like, what is fulfilling. And I feel like in many ways, religion can fit the definition that I was thinking about, which is that you're kind of, you know, when you're reading from Safaria or when you're just talking about some Talmudic idea, like, you're kind of in the moment thinking about it, and very like present and kind of focused on what's being said and how it applies to your life. And it's much more thought provoking than like a lot of the other things you could be doing with that same time, you know?
Most definitely. I like to say that time well spent is time that you take with you. And I think when you grapple with these ideas, they stay with you. As you mentioned, you had a nugget of an idea and then you take it with you. You talk about it, you think about it afterwards. Unfortunately, a lot of the ideas we are exposed to otherwise, we're learning them for some other reason, and they're not really intrinsically of value to us. And I think that's a beautiful, that's always the definition of meaning. I think I totally agree with you, is being present and taking the moment with you. I think that's what creates a truly meaningful existence. Well, anyway, thank you so much, Matt, for all your insights and for sharing a little bit about your personal journey and your experiences. And I think we've all gained a tremendous amount from hearing about it. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, appreciate it. And yeah, always a pleasure.